should be a fun one to close out the week. Martin St. Louis will be aboard here in a couple of moments. Brian Lawton from the NHL Network. Breck Hedekin, Sharks radio analyst, former NHL defenseman. What a skater there. And Rick Vive, former NHLer, former 50-goal scorer. A couple of different times with the Toronto Maple Leafs. He will be aboard in hour two. Good afternoon, Brian Burke. Good afternoon, Justin Bourne. Hockey Central is on the air. Berkey, the big story going around right now. We'll get you to weigh in quickly here. Before we give way to Martin St. Louis, the NHL Players Association Executive Board voting on this 24-team return-to-play format. Now, the full PA board is voting today, so that would include players on teams that wouldn't qualify for the 24-team playoff sprint. Where is Brian Burke at right now on this Friday with this proposal in the hands of the Players Association? What should we look for later on tonight by way of result?
Well, I expect it to be ratified. I think it's great news if they can pull it off. My fear continues to be the safety of the players. I'm not sure the testing is accurate enough or that there will be enough of it. But those are two issues that could be resolved well before we get to this point.
And again, just so our listeners understand this, I mean, even if the Players Association give this, as Brian mentioned, the green light and support it, and Justin, you know this very well, this is only the framework of what the postseason would look like if they get the go-ahead. This is not to imply that that it's full steam ahead and the NHL is coming back. This is just so they have the model in place should they be able to play.
Yeah, and you know, I think they're really close to something pretty good here. There's no perfect format. Just looking at it, the way it would shake out, there's certainly a couple teams, a couple Canadian teams too, who would not love the way it's kind of bounces for them. Edmonton loses their crack at home ice and suddenly goes up against you know, a pretty good Blackhawks team. But you know, there's like we said, there's no perfect way to do this. It seems like a good format, and it seems like, as Berkey mentioned, it'll end up getting ratified. They've got to make some decisions at this point.
The opening round would be best of five, and after that, once you get to the 16, there would be the traditional format of the best of seven series. Do we want to nitpick this one at all? I mean, Justin, you mentioned, you know, man, this is tough for the Edmonton Oilers. You know, a scant couple of points away from first place, and all of a sudden they have to face off against the Blackhawks team that has, you know, Patrick Kane on it and Jonathan.
Just to get in playoffs.
It's just to get in to what the playoffs is, but. I don't know, guys. Find me the perfect solution in a very imperfect world right now. I don't see it. I look at this and I say, okay, if they can do it, let's play ball.
I agree. There is no perfect solution, and individual teams could have some beefs about this that are legitimate. But the fact is, it does account for the teams that were in the hunt at the end, hit the pause. Mm-hmm. And it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good.
Sorry, Justin, go ahead.
I just, you know, the one thing that I'm curious about why it didn't end up happening, which, you know, I wouldn't know how to do it myself, but just some handicapping so the top teams would have a more advantageous chance of getting in and the bottom teams not. I know there are some formulas, some people who worked it out that it can work. So I'm just curious why that didn't happen. I probably to give every team a chance and make it exciting. I don't know exactly.
Well, you know, the first round is always it is a wild first round of the playoffs, and now you make this best of five, and all of a sudden you could have a heavyweight team on the ropes even before you get to the playoffs. You know, fair has always been a weird word for me. I don't like it. If it were up to me, I'd rip it out of the dictionary. I don't believe in the word fair. Fair doesn't exist. You only get what you negotiate. Fair to one person is not fair to another person. We're going to get into this a little bit later on the program, but is it fair for the Edmonton Oilers? Probably not. But again, in this imperfect situation that we're in, I'm fine with this format. More on that in moments. Martin St. Louis, a Hall of Fame forward, is standing by. Marty, thanks so much for doing this. We want to open up, obviously, with the obvious question. How are you doing? How's your family doing? What is a day-to-day existence like for Martin St. Louis right now?
Well, we're fine through these, you know, crazy times. My oldest son lived in Detroit at the time, so he's going to be 17. He came home right away. Mm-hmm. And I have two other boys 15 and 12. So we quarantined pretty much, you know, in our house for a while. And eventually just saw the data and stuff just was not looking good. I'm in Connecticut, and I ended up just packing the family and going to Florida. We've been in Florida for a while and quarantined for a couple of weeks, and now we're kind of living the way life is down here, which is a little bit more open. You know, the boys are golfing, and we're able to get some ice. And so we have more of a normal life, I guess, than what we had back home.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, yours is a very strong hockey family. Like the San Luis, like, hockey didn't end, you know, at the end of your career. This is a hockey family, the San Luis. What are you doing to quench that thirst right now?
Well, when we were home in Connecticut, you know, we just did a lot of stuff in the garage. And, you know, I have enough gym equipment and was able to, you know, put them to help them out through some workouts and whatnot, and working on things in the garage and hands and shots. And actually, I kind of enjoyed that part. I did a lot of that on my own playing, and now I get the three boys and trying to work on their games and trying to, you know, help them out in some of the things they need to work on. And they're all kind of doing it together. So it's actually pretty cool.
Berkey, go ahead.
Hey, Marty, it's Berkey. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Berkey.
So I want to talk about, before you got to the NHL, the University of Vermont Catamounts, 95-96. You had 85 points, and you lost in double overtime in the Frozen Four final game. Tell us about that.
It's funny because I was on the Zoom last night with my college teammate. You know, and some of you don't know, I played with, you know, Timmy Thomas and Eric Perrin, who ended up winning the cup with me in 04, and had a career in the NHL in Europe. We got together last night and actually watched a Lake State game, which is the game before. Johnny Graham was in that. You know, that 95-96 team was just a great team. You know, we had a lineup of seniors, and they were great leaders, and they gave us a lot. We had some role players, and obviously our top line was really good, and we had a guy by the name of J.C. Ruid. He was 6'4", scored 29 goals that year. My centerman, Eric, had 29 goals. I had 29 goals. So it was a special group. And then, you know, we had in the back, we had Timmy, you know, and Timmy was an unbelievable goalie. And it's funny, I hope Timmy doesn't mind me talking about that, because I found out something last night about Timmy. Is Timmy was a late addition. I came in that 93. Timmy was my class, but our starting goalie was supposed to be a junior from Montreal, and he's Christian Soucy. He signed with Chicago in July, I believe, and now they're scrambling to find a goalie. And Timmy had gone to the U.S. Festival that summer at a pretty good run, I guess. But rewind like 6 months before the U.S. Festival, Timmy was a third goalie in the NHL and playing in the North American Hockey League. He was a third goalie in like November. And he just told that story last night on the Zoom. And he actually played out. He went to play out. You see, he was a skater for a little bit because he wasn't playing. So he wanted to play. So he played as a forward. And Christmas time happened, and he went – one of the goalies, I think, he said he was from Alaska and went home and had a tough time getting back or something. And then the other goalie got hurt. So Timmy got the net after Christmas because the other goalies couldn't play. And he never gave the net back. And then he's gone to the festival, and that's how we actually got him, you know, because they saw him there. And so he was a late addition. I mean, gosh, what a great call on taking that kid. I mean, I mean, without Timmy, we don't have the success we had in college. And he was such a great competitor and a teammate. And I'm so happy he got inducted into the U.S. Hall of Fame. And, you know, it was special times for sure.
So, Marty, you go from Vermont and into your foray into the professional hockey and you know, spend some time in the American League. And in over your first sort of 3-4 NHL seasons, you play a couple hundred games and score just over 90 points. And then something changes for you, at least statistically, if you look at your career. What clicked for you sort of heading into that 2002-2003 season where you doubled your goal total and point total and sort of took off into the offensive force that we knew you as in the NHL?
I mean, for me, it was definitely a progression at the NHL level. Every level I played, I always put numbers. I always felt good. I always felt like I was one of the better players on the ice. When I got to the NHL, I was almost like, intimidated by all the stars and everything, and I almost, you know, was selling myself short, you know. And eventually, I just started gradually gaining confidence and just turning it around and just changing my thinking a little bit. And it really, I really found out that, you know, if you don't believe in yourself, nobody will. And I really start, you know, turning that in my mind and start playing with more confidence. And, you know, what's the worst case scenario? Like I'm, you know, I was getting scratched. So what was the worst case scenario? I'm going to get scratched again. Like, you know, for me, changing my thinking, there was so much more upside than, you know, staying the way I was. And obviously with, you know, it was a gradual thing. And then Torts gave me the opportunity and the players that I was playing with, you know, I had Richards at center and Le Cavalier at center, and I would bounce back and forth. And I either play with Modine or Fedotenko on the left side. I mean, those guys have, you know, heck of a career, and they were awesome people. So for me, it was definitely a progression. And once I got to the top, I definitely felt comfortable, but it was definitely a uncomfortable beginning.
You know, and we're talking to Martin St. Louis, Hall of Fame forward. One of the things that I always admired about your game, every time I watched you play, well, first of all, you never made excuses. And second of all, Marty, it always seemed as if you had a chip on your shoulder. And we can understand where that all came from. You never lost that, did you? Because it never seemed as if you did. You always skated like it seemed you had something to prove. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely something that I always felt I had something to prove. Even when I was a star in this league, I felt like I had to do it again, you know. And, mm-hmm. and somebody, the big difference between, you know, a third, fourth line guy and a guy who's you know, at the top on the team and in the league, every year, you know, people are looking at you. Is he doing it again? And now you're bringing the age factor and you're aging and stuff, you know. Is he on his decline? It always felt like there was always something to prove, like you said. And I think for me, I think I was a driven individual, and I didn't want to let that go. I want to stay there, and I definitely owe a lot to, you know, Ben Prentice and my trainer. I met Ben like I was like 29 years old, 30 years old. I don't think if I don't meet Ben, I'm as good in my late 30s, in my mid to late 30s. I don't think I sign another 4-year deal. You know, at 37. You know, I led the league in scoring at 37. I don't think I do that. And Ben really helped me out, you know, staying fit and staying strong. And, you know, and the league was constantly getting faster. And as you know, as you age, you always feel you're getting slower. But I actually feel like the league is getting faster. I wasn't really getting slower, if it makes sense. And so you really had to, you know, make sure you take care of yourself. And I felt I did that.
Berkey?
Yeah, and Marty, I want to focus on the age of your first NHL game. You were 23. Your first breakout season in 2002-2003, you were 27. And yet you ended up with well over 1,000 NHL games and 1,000 NHL points. There's a lesson in there for a young player about perseverance, and there's a lesson in there for parents that it doesn't always have to happen right away.
Yeah, for me, honestly, like going to college – I mean, at 18, I was 160 pounds, you know. I wasn't worried about it. I wasn't in the NHL at 18, honestly. You know, I was just trying to get better every year. But I really liked the fact that I just had a longer runway. You know, going to college gave me a longer runway that I could just develop and get better. And, you know, and I felt when I hit 22, 23, I was kind of ready. And, you know, for me, if I played junior and it didn't pan out at 20, I don't know where I'm at. I needed those extra years to develop. And see, it's not a race to get up there. It's once you get there, make sure you're ready. you know. So I, you know, I, you know, people want to get called up and stuff. Yeah, but let's make sure you get called up when you're ready. Don't get called up just to get called up, you know, because you, this might be your only chance that you're going to get the show.
Marty, I have a question fairly specific to our Toronto audience here. I worked a little bit with Sheldon Keefe for the Toronto Marlies and got to know him, and he's made quite sort of an evolution personally as a, you know, as a man from his early days as a player to the head coach that he is today. I wonder what your recollections of him are as a player. You guys would have been, I guess, rookies together or around that time in Tampa Bay, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I believe we came around the same time, and I remember Sheldon really well. He was a worker, you know. He was a worker, and he really he was a quiet kid, liked to laugh, but you know, he went to the rink and worked every day, and he played that way, you know. But he wasn't a big guy like me, you know, and it was still a big man's game, and but he played. He was feisty, and he played with a lot of energy. I enjoyed Sheldon when he was with us, and I'm not surprised that he's having success as a coach, because I always felt he was working on his game all the time and always trying to get better, and I can see why he's had success.
You know, speaking of coaching, we all know you're an outstanding youth hockey coach. You talked about, you know, your sons and working out in the garage and firing pucks, and it's the summer of shooting pads. You know, I was having this conversation with someone a few days ago. You know, I wonder if, and you'll be a lot closer to it with more insight than I have, Marty, I wonder if this is the summer, and I'm talking about youth hockey, or as we call it, minor hockey here in Canada. This is the summer where we see a shooting spike, where all of a sudden the shots take this huge leap, because essentially, with, you know, the majority of rinks closed, that's really all they have to work with. Are you gonna pick up the theory that I'm putting down here? We're gonna see a shooting spike with youth hockey.
I mean, you'll definitely maybe see the skill. I mean, it's hard to believe that the kids can get more skilled than they are right now. But, you know, that's what the kids are doing right now. They're working on that. And listen, I can see this. I can see the improvement for my own kids doing what they've been doing for, you know, a few months, and just really focusing on specific, because you're not on a team. You can't skate. You're just focusing on small skill that really can impact your overall game. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I feel the skill level is at an unbelievable place right now. And just the fact that the thought that it could get even higher, it's crazy.
Have your kids asked you at all how to do the Austin Matthews release yet?
No, I can't really teach that. I think they pick it up on their own, honestly, with the you know, the internet and all the social media. So, you know, it's that's one thing that's great about the game today is, you know, some kid does something crazy in Czech or Russia, you know, and you see it instantly, and the kids can really try to imitate that. Where when we grew up, you had to see it on the outdoor rink. You had to be there. You had to see it to be, oh, wow, I should try to do that, you know. You had to be present.
That's an excellent point. Berkey?
Got to ask you about the cup year, Marty. Well, 304, Art Ross Trophy, Stanley Cup. Talk about that team and the run you made.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a perfect balance. We had, you know, I wasn't as young as Richie and Vinny, but, you know, games played, I was probably right around the same, you know, and we were just kind of coming into our own. And we had some swagger with it because of the success we had the year before, too. It was just kind of, you know, we rolled into the next year, and throughout that year, we all had some great success. And then we had brought, you know, obviously Dave Enderchuk, Tim Taylor, you know, then they brought the Sid Daryl Sador at the deadline. Like, we had unbelievable leadership, and Freddie Modine, you know, one of the best human I know, one of the best teammates I've played with, you know, and you had Habib Bulin in that. So, you know, anything that's going to have success, you know, really the backbone is the goalie. So, you know, for me, it all kind of came together, and I think we all learned a lot from each other. I got better playing with guys like Richie and Vinny, and I learned so much from the leaders on the team, and Dave and Tells and Sid and Mo, and we just kind of rolled with it, and really felt that we could do it. We weren't worried where we were. We weren't worried at what was supposed to be. We just went after it.
And I got to ask you about the fight. A lot of people, the only thing they remember about that series was the fight. Tell us about the fight.
You know, Vinny was a tough guy, man. I mean, you know, played, scored 50 goals and still fought a lot of guys. And when I played with Vinny, I felt like I always had more room. And I think Vinny, once he fought again like that, it gave him so much confidence and respect. And for us, obviously, it definitely fueled us. Like, we just, like, you know, you want to go block shot with your face when you see him doing that, you know? So it had a huge impact on our success. I think it had a huge impact on my career, on his career, because there was time in the years after that coming back to the bench, and Vinny was like, "Marty, did so-and-so hit you dirty? Did so?" He wanted to know if it was a cheap shot, because he's going after him, you know, which that's a guy who's scoring 50 goals, 40 goals. And I never felt comfortable telling him the truth, because I didn't want him to go fight, you know. But there's plenty of times that if he saw it, there was no, like, he didn't care what the puck was. He came in there and just charged, and it gave me a lot of room.
That's Justin, awesome. We'll finish up with you.
I was hoping to ask you a gear-based question. I'm fascinated to get your thoughts on hockey sticks, and you always used a long stick for a guy your size. Those yellow sticks you used, I think they were Warriors, if I'm not mistaken. Did you try shorter sticks? Do you have thoughts on why you went with a longer stick throughout your career?
I don't know. When I left college, I felt my stick was long, but it just kind of evolved to that. And when I got to the NHL, I definitely felt like the need to have a longer stick to play, because you can play so much better defensively with a long stick than a short stick. And obviously, when I came in, I was, you know, kind of in a defensive role. So to me, it was a perfect fit, you know, and I was used to it. And the yellow stick started with Easton when they, you know, I think in 2002. They had the yellow, the orange, I believe, and I got the yellow. And in 03, the first year I took it, I scored 30 and I went to the All-Star game. So I wasn't switching. And the rest of my career, you know, I was very superstitious. I wasn't switching. I ended up going to Warrior later in my career, because Easton was, they were done making my stick. They didn't want to make the yellow stick anymore. So I went to Warrior. But as the game changed, you know, the game became more of a wrist shot and one-timers, a little bit less coming down the wing taking slappers, that, you know, the shorter stick for me with more of a toe curve, more flex, and definitely I got shorter. My stick changed dramatically from the, you know, my first few years to my last few years. But that should be that way, I feel, because the game changes. As a player, you have to evolve, and the equipment's part of it.
Love these conversations. Marty, you've been generous with your time. Thanks so much to you and your family. All the best. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Look forward to catching up down the road. Always good to catch up with a Hall of Famer. Thanks, Marty.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me. Everyone out there, stay safe, and hopefully we get past this. Thanks much.
Amen. Martin St. Louis, Hockey Hall of Famer, Stanley Cup champion as well. Just a quick around the table before we go to break, guys, and Berkey, we'll start with you. Just a general thought on Martin St. Louis. Personally, he was one of my favorites to watch when he was in the league. What do you say about the Hall of Famer?
Well, he's Hall of Fame. Like I say, he didn't have really success in the league until he was 27 and ended up with over 1,000 games and over 1,000 points. This is a guy that was outstanding in the years through his 27th to 33rd year. He had a broken leg early in his career that set him back. But this should be an inspiration to any player who's a little bit smaller, because you can get there if you work hard enough and you're smart enough and skilled enough.
I've got two thoughts. One is that I want to do a project to go through Marty St. Louis' sticks over his career and check out the evolution of how they grew in length and then shortened again at the end. You know, added toe curve. I think that stuff's fascinating. The other is that last week David Amber asked us, after watching The Last Dance, what NHL players would be most like Michael Jordan in terms of demeanor and comportment. And I think you could make a case for St. Louis, who is a pretty serious guy, very competitive guy, and just that nature always seemed, that never stop attitude seems to be such a part of what drove him to the success he had.
And never complained. Like never once, Berkey, I know you'll love the story if you haven't heard me tell it before. It was a Tampa, I think it was a Tampa-Ottawa series, and he had been hit high in the third period in the post game. He's out there in front of the reporters, and he's still got the cut on his nose, and there's a trickle going down his face. And one of the reporters asked him if he think there should have been a call or even a suspension on the play, and he shut the guy down right away and said, No. It's a hit. It happens. This is playoff hockey. I have to expect that. I'm a smaller guy. I'm going to get hit. There's no excuses here. Whereas, I mean, how many other guys would be screaming for multiple games and the referees are blind and all that? And there's Marty St. Louis saying, no way, man. Game on. This is hockey. This is just the cost of doing business. Love that guy. Brian Lawton joins us in a couple of moments from the NHL Network. We'll get his thoughts on his career and also where the NHL and the Players Association are at with a return to play proposal. Hockey Central continues. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to the program here Monday to Friday, noon to 2. Welcome once again to Hockey Central. Merrick alongside Burke and Bourne. We're standing by for Brian Lawton from the NHL Network. He'll be here in moments. Brett Hedekin poised to join us to kick off Hour 2. San Jose Sharks radio analyst and former NHL defenseman. Man, was he quick. And Rick Vibe coming down the wing, winding up with the clapper, former Toronto Maple Leaf, former NHL forward. Rick Vibe, RV, will be dropping by the program a little bit later on. As we mentioned, guys, the headline story of the day, the full NHL Players Association board voting on this idea of a return-to-play format. And, you know, it was interesting, Patrick Laine, do you guys see the Patrick Laine quote? Patrick Laine was asked, you know, what his game would be like should they return. And should come as no surprise, the always candid, always honest Patrick Laine responded, my game is probably going to look terrible. No mincing of words, no putting a shine on the performance at all. That is Patrick Laine. Justin, what do you think the hockey will look like when, if/when they do get back to playing?
Well, ugly, you know, but in a very entertaining way. Like, the games are going to matter right out of the gate, so you're certainly going to get everyone's best effort. But I think back to a time in summer hockey where Danny Heatley had been off the ice for 3 or 4 months, and he came back to skate in our summer game. And, like, I can't even describe how bad a 50-goal scorer looked at hockey. Like, I just remember him toe-picking on a breakaway, and, like, just completely fanning on pucks. Like, even the best players need their reps, so I expect it to be a little bit ugly for a while.
What do you think, Berkey?
Kind of the same, but a little better than that. I think that these players really, if they get they're talking about a 3-week training camp. I think that's ambitious, but say they get 3 weeks, or even just two, they don't really get out of shape anymore, players, so more of timing, and there'll be some mistakes. But like in the Bundesliga, they're saying the soccer isn't 100%, but it's not 80% either. It's somewhere over 90.
Right. Let's get Brian Lawton aboard from the NHL Network. Brian, how are you today? Thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Well, I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing good. Let me just drag you into this conversation we're having. And I don't know if you saw the Patrick Laine quote about, you know, what his game is going to look like should they return to action. He said, my game is probably going to look terrible. He's always an interesting interview. One of our favorite quotes. Well, Justin weighed in, Berkey weighed in moments ago. We'll give you a chance now as well. If/when they return, what do you think it looks like? Will it be sloppy, or will these guys be able to click back together like all the sides on a Rubik's Cube?
I know Patrick a little bit, and you never know if he's joking or serious, but I will say this about him. Last summer was the first time that he really started to take hockey seriously, which may sound strange because he was already pretty darn good, as everybody knows. But there was a dynamic change in his attitude about how he handled himself in the off season. If he's telling us that he's not doing it this year, because this really has been the off season, it's certainly a possibility. But my suspicion is he may be just, he's actually a pretty funny kid. And I was encouraged, obviously, by the changes I saw in his game this year. He looked like a different player. And a lot of the things that I've heard Berkey talk about, and even Justin and myself, that we didn't like about his game, he made a lot of corrections. He made big steps forward. So I hope he's joking, is what I'm saying.
Berkey, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with Lotsy. I thought he was a real liability when he wasn't scoring goals his first couple of years. And this year he committed to a three-zone game and was dramatically better, making passes, making plays, back-checking. I think he's one of the most improved players in the National Hockey League.
Yeah. He turned it up, Berkey, in his off-ice training. The guy had never trained. He's a monster of a man, but he was kind of skinny, kind of weak for his size, and he actually put the time and effort in last summer in Finland to address those things, and I think it helped him round his game out. So, you know, I mean, this guy's a world-class talent, and the things that were being said and the contemplation that Winnipeg might actually trade a guy like that was insane, and yet he kind of brought it upon himself, and he also fixed it. So good for him. You love to see that from young people.
I agree.
Justin, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. I'm hoping you can tell. Something that's been weirding me out a little bit on this show is every person we have on who's an American hockey person of sort of note seems to be from Woonsocket. What's the deal with Woonsocket? Why is it such a apparently a hockey hotbed that I had never heard of?
I'm not from Woonsocket. Brian Burke has been in Woonsocket many times in his life. He's not from there. But I did go to high school there. Town over. But Woonsocket is very laden with a very French-Canadian past history. And that's really what it's known for. And it's actually a wonderful place that apparently is much safer now than when I grew up. So that's good.
what do you think? I mean, we were talking with Mike Modano about this recently, about, you know, that generation of U.S.-born player who were all influenced certainly by the Miracle on Ice in 1980. But that was that first sort of collage of players that put together U.S. teams to compete internationally. And that really formed, in a lot of ways, a foundation of excellence that we see carried through right now. Like, sporadically, there have been moments of greatness for the United States. And we think of Squaw Valley in 1960. We think of Lake Placid in 1980. But it really wasn't until that Modano bunch that they all came together. The 96 World Cup was huge and formed a consistently great team. And we still see that now with USA Hockey. What do you see when you see American hockey players? And what do you think of the program that is USA Hockey right now?
If you think about it, Jeff, like Phil Housley was, what, the sixth pick in 1982. Bobby Carpenter was third, I guess, in 1981. The U.S. Olympic team was the biggest story in hockey in American history. And I was obviously selected in 83. But it wasn't, although I absolutely enjoyed the Olympic story and it was very meaningful in my life, it helped me to dream much bigger. It was that inspirational. I actually played hockey more because of Brian Burke on the line and the Providence Friars, which is where I grew up, and college hockey was very popular. But even more than that, the Boston Bruins. So if you fast forward to, what year was Mo drafted? 89, 90? 89? No, 88.
88. Him and Linden.
Yes, 88. He didn't start till 89. He went back for an extra year of junior. But if you go back, the U.S. Olympic team, it took a number of years. It took kids that were younger than myself. I was 14 when they won the gold medal. It influenced me, but I was already on a track where I had fallen in love with hockey because of the Bruins, because of Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito and how popular they were in the region, and because of Providence College and going to see those games as a kid. Mike Modano and Billy Guerin and all that group afterwards, Brian Leach, Scotty Young, those were kids that I think were young enough at the time that the U.S. Olympics allowed them to dream bigger, and those were drivers why they got into the sport and how we got all these great athletes going in that direction. So it's a little bit of a fallacy that certainly Carpenter, Housley, myself, players like that, Eddie Olchuk, we're driven by the U.S. Olympic team. We love the story, but it was something else that drove us.
Berkey?
Yeah, so Lotsy, who am I describing here? Former player, although you're a little better than I am. It was agent, GM, now in the media. who am I describing?
What are you saying, Berkey? You've done more things than anybody in this sport. Somewhere behind that.
Well, I remember your draft year. It was a big deal. You going first overall was a big deal. That was a good draft. Phil Turgeon went after you, Patty LaFontaine, Steve Yzerman, Tom Barrasso, Cam Neely. That was a pretty good draft. You were first overall. Pretty big news.
It was big news, but honestly, in covering the draft now for NHL Network, I always joke with the kids. I've just finished interviewing a bunch of kids for this year's draft, and the 72nd pick gets more attention because of the world we live in today, particularly with social media, than I probably did way back in 1983. It was just different. I don't think I've ever said this to you, Berkey, but I was not going to the draft like 2 weeks before the draft. I was in high school. I was graduating, I think, the weekend after it. And I was not going to the NHL draft. As it turns out, on the day of the draft, I actually arrived late because I ran into Jodie Foster in the elevator in the Manoir Lemoyne.
No
I knew
way.
That this girl was a movie star and started talking to her. I got over to the forum right when I got called. So there's a lot of funny things about that time way back when.
Who were the
It wasn't like now. The attention that these kids get is incredible.
Who were some of the kids you were talking to?
In the last 10 days, I interviewed Lafreniere, Byfield, Drysdale, Stützle, Marco Rossi yesterday. Cole Perfetti showed us his Rubik's Cube skills on air the other day. That was impressive. Jake Sanderson. I interviewed Pat Bersan's son as well. It's been a delight to be able to take advantage of this unique time that we have to be able to sit down and actually interview these kids for, 30 minutes or so, the way that a lot of National Hockey League clubs are doing. This is a really unique year for the draft, and it's been delightful to see how great some teams are doing. Some teams could pick it up a little bit, in my opinion, in that department, because I'm asking all these kids when I talk to them. But for the most part, the really good organizations in this league right now, and I can name those. I won't name the ones that I think could pick it up, but Boston, Chicago, there's a number of them. These guys have really been progressive in taking advantage of this unique time.
Which of the kids impressed you the most?
Cole Perfetti was just a delight to interview. Very intelligent. Kind of reminds me of an Italian Boston kid in some ways, which was a surprise to me. But the level of professionalism was off the charts from him. He sent me a note afterwards, just things you don't see from 17, 18, even 19-year-old kids. Lafreniere, he reminds me very much of, some of the superstars in the league now that we've seen in the past that maybe I knew from when I was a general manager, like Tavares and Hedman, just how far ahead some of these kids are because they've been exposed maybe as a, junior superstar, Hedman playing in a professional league. It's been all over the map. Byfield, I thought, did a nice job, but he is one of the younger players in the draft, and you can somewhat glean that from the interviews, although he was absolutely wonderful to talk to. Lafreniere, one of the older guys, like Marco Rossi, you can see that difference in just 7-8 months of maturity. It's incredible.
Yep, Brian, sure.
Justin?
Yeah, I was hoping we could get your take on something. You have a long, extensive background in hockey, and one of the things that interests me is I think it's been lost to history how the AHL and the IHL were almost kind of neck and neck in terms of importance once upon a time. My dad was a coach in the league in 93 in the International Hockey League, and then again in the late 90s. I know you spent parts of three seasons with three different IHL teams. Could you tell us a little bit about, you know, the IHL and how close things were there, and why it lost the battle, I guess, for minor hockey supremacy to the AHL?
Yeah, they were always very close. It was a different time then. Obviously, teams had their farm teams spread across these two leagues, versus one, which we see today, which I think is a better system, quite frankly. But it was really just a geographical issue. Essentially, the IHL was the western division of the AHL way back when, which was predominantly along the East Coast, up and down the coast, quite a ways. But the IHL, you know, it tended to have more independent franchises back then, so they were not as adverse to signing maybe players that weren't those prototypical prospects that you see in the AHL today, and it gave a little bit different flavor. It was almost like it was a little bit more mature in terms of the group of players you were playing with. It was certainly, there's things that come along with that, a little bit different attitude. You were flying places versus busing. It was completely different, but ultimately the hockey forces came together and it ended up the way it should be, which is basically, and Brian knows about this as well as anybody, having had, you know, teams in the American League now on the East Coast, like the Marlies, and on the West Coast, like he did when he was in Calgary. So I think it's a good thing. It just was different, though. There was definitely a different flavor. Mm. And amongst the players, it was separated by, on the basis that you might get a little more money in the eye, hockey might be a little bit more wide open, and you were flying places predominantly versus busing.
With Brian Lawton from the NHL Network. You know, Brian, back in 2006, coming out of the lockout, there was a real sort of, I want to say, jump ball type vibe around the league, as every team and every player had to relearn how to play this game with a new rules package and new standard for enforcement, and the Carolina Hurricanes ended up winning the Stanley Cup. This is not to take anything away from the Carolina Hurricanes, but I look at this season, and if they get back to it at some point this summer, I don't think it'll be the same because the game is still the same. But do you think it's going to be jump ball to see who wins the Stanley Cup this time around? Like, we have our, you know, the four in each conference that are going to get that first round bye, although they'll play a little tournament to vie for position. But do you see any teams having an advantage, any teams significantly disadvantaged? And is this going to be a, you know, pick 'em Stanley Cup?
I do think it'll be more wide open than we've seen since then. I reconcile that period in my mind. It was kind of the end of the super teams. If you think about who won cups from like 95 to 04, essentially it was three teams that dominated: New Jersey, Colorado, and Detroit. Right? Jersey won three. Well, Detroit win three, Colorado won two, does that sound right? I think Dallas won one in 99 as well, to throw them in. But if you looked at all those teams, you know, we had this era going on where, you know, it was almost kind of like basketball, where collectively you could get these great groups of players. But because there was no salary cap, there was definitely, you know, I mean, just to analyze those teams, you'd be shocked how many Hall of Famers were on the rosters of the different teams that were winning. If I look at St. Louis last year, and that's why I say we're in a different era today, I don't know. I'll ask you guys, who's going to be a definitive Hall of Fame player from the St. Louis Blues last year? Anybody?
It's no one leaps out.
Yeah.
No one jumps out at all.
Say, you know, Petrangelo's. Yeah, Tarasenko's been good. Petrangelo's been good. O'Reilly's been good. Maybe Jordan Binnington, we could say, but he's in the, you know, second inning of his career.
Infancy, yeah.
So it just was a totally, yeah, it was a totally different era back then, Jeff. We had just gone to zero tolerance on hooking and holding. Berkey will remember this because he was a part of all this in a big way. There were massive changes. We're not going to have necessarily those massive changes, but yet I say it'll be wide open because we've already transitioned, in my opinion, to this new era. After that era I described, we went to I call it the be bad to be good era, right? The more you sucked, the higher draft picks you got, and you built Pittsburgh, even Washington to some degree, even though they only won one cup in that 08-18 time period. But Chicago, they were certainly dominant. Pittsburgh, they were dominant. Even L.A. to a degree built a large part of their team off of their draft picks. That era, I think, has ended. Now we're into this new era where we have more competitive balance. That's making it wide open. Now we have a pandemic. That's going to bring it to where you're saying, in my opinion, Jeff, where we haven't seen it be this wide open in a long, long time. It's exciting, in my opinion, because people want to see new champions crowned. And even though I loved what Pittsburgh did, those times are further, fewer and further in between in the future, in my opinion. We're not going to see a New York Islander team rip off four cups in a row or anything like that. It's just too much parity, too much disbursement of talent. And that's a good thing if you're a fan of that.
Yeah.
I like
it. Yeah, you're right. It's forced a redefinition of what a dynasty is. I don't think we're going to see another Islanders squad ripping off four, or Habs ripping off four, Oilers winning four in five seasons. I think it's a new definition of what a dynasty is around the NHL. Brian, always a good time catching up. Be well, be safe, and we'll look for more of your contributions down the road, hopefully sooner than later. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, guys. Thanks for having me on.
There is Brian Lawton from the NHL Network. Quick pause. I want to get your thoughts, guys, on what this will look like. Will this be jump ball, or will there still be favorites should they get this thing back on the ice? Hockey Central continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We're back in a moment. Okay, guys, only about 60 seconds here to dive into a quick little thought experiment on what should probably take longer, but here we go. Just talked to Brian Lawton about this and asked the question, will this be jump ball based on this format and this layoff? Should they get the game back on the ice? Brian, what do you think? Is there such a thing as a favorite after a pause like this?
I think that if I'm in one of these play-in series, it's going to come down to goaltending. If I have a goaltender that can steal me a game, that's enough to win a best of five. So that changes the total stress and preparation. I'm going to stress D-zone schemes more in my short camp. I think size will matter in a short series, and special teams will be a key. These are all platitudes, but goaltending, if Carey Price can steal a game or two,
look out. Justin, what say you?
I like older teams. You know, usually by the end of the season, the older teams, the wear and tear is really affecting them. I think getting a little rest for guys like, say, Chara, Bergeron, and Marchand, I think it'll go a long way for guys like that.
As every Maple Leafs fan listening to this show just cringes.
Cringes.
We'll hit a break. Hour two is on the horizon. Look forward to talking to Rick Vive, former NHLer, former 50-goal scorer of the Toronto Maple Leafs, for joining us after the top of the hour break. San Jose Sharks radio analyst and former NHL defenseman and smooth skater, smooth talker as well. Brett Hedekin joins us as Hockey Central continues. Hour two is next on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Welcome back to the program. We are here Monday to Friday, noon to 2. Glad you could join us today on this Friday. 1 hour left on Hockey Central for the day and for the week. Brett Hedekin, Sharks radio analyst, will be dropping by, former NHL defenseman, and Rick Vive towards the bottom of the hour. Former 50-goal scorer with the Toronto Maple Leafs, a former NHL forward. We'll get RV's thoughts on the game today and his career. Guys, alongside Brian Burke and Justin Bourne, guys, just to reset for those that weren't with us in hour one, the very latest is there is a full NHLPA board voting on the return to play proposal. This is the 24-team playoff format with a best of five play-in round, getting us to the 16 that we're used to. And after that is a best of seven for every series. Guys, is there any way to hot take this one, or do we just say making the best out of a bad situation? Berkey, we'll start with you.
Making the best out of a bad situation, making a really good solution out of a bad situation. Nothing, no format they propose would be perfect. There are problems with this proposal, but it's 90% right, and it's going to produce a legitimate Stanley Cup champion if they can play the games, and I like it.
How about, you know, I'm going to kick this over back to you, Berkey, and I hate to put you on the spot here because we haven't talked about it before, but what would you think of an idea, like let's say Chicago and Edmonton have to play in this best of five, Chicago's far out of the playoffs and way below Edmonton the standings, an idea where Chicago would have to beat Edmonton four times in five games to get through, where Edmonton just needs to win two to advance?
No, Edmonton's getting rewarded by playing a lower seed because they had a good regular season. That's their reward. They're in a series now that they're expected to win. It doesn't mean they're going to, because Chicago won't lie down for them. But that's the reward for playing 85% of the regular season at a high level.
Let me take that one and use that same example one step further. Brian, before the break, you talked about, you know, give me a hot goaltender. That's why Carey Price is dangerous. So if you're the Pittsburgh Penguins and you're coming back and you're playing against the Habs, this is anything but a layup. We've seen Corey Crawford get hot before. Could that be a series that Corey Crawford could just flat out steal? Like, we all know the issues that Chicago has with their back end. That's all well told. But if a short series, best of five, you have that hot Corey Crawford, could you not see a leveling of the playing field between these two teams that, based on the standings at the pause, look light years apart?
For sure, but the two best goalies this year for me were first half of the year was Darcy Kemper, second half of the year was Connor Hellebuck. If I were playing Winnipeg and I were Calgary, I'd be real nervous about that matchup because of the goaltending. And not that Calgary's goaltending hasn't been good, but Connor Hellebuck's been lights out. In the first half of the season until he got hurt, Darcy Kemper, same thing.
Those are excellent points. Pause on that program, on that conversation, because Brett Hedekin, Sharks radio analyst and former NHL defenseman, joins us on Hockey Central. Brett, good of you to be aboard. How are you? How is the family? Please tell us that everyone is safe and healthy.
Everyone's safe and healthy out here. Thanks for having me on, guys. Yeah, it's been obviously difficult times for everybody and obviously strange times. But overall, things are good here in California. And just trying to stay busy as I can out here to just go about life.
What is life for you like right now? Give us your day to day.
Yeah, I've been quite busy. When this whole thing started, I kind of started to dive into my university, and you know, when I left college after my junior season to make the Olympic team, and then after the Olympics, I turned pro. I've slowly chipped away through the years. You know, during the work stoppage in 2004, I went back to school at the University of San Francisco. I took some courses at Cal Berkeley as well over the years. And then finally, here I was during this whole pandemic. I reached out to my university, and they gave me a few credits for my broadcasting I've done over the last 10 years. And we added it all together, and I realized I'm 15 credits shy of graduating. So I went back to school. I finished one class just last Monday, and I started another one on the same day. So I'm kind of chipping away, and after this class, I'll have 9 credits to graduate. So it's been something that, for me, it's kept me busy. That's one thing I've been doing. And then I you know, trying to keep my body moving as well. I do kung fu every day, so that's something that has kept my body going. So staying
busy.
Hang on
a second. You're destroying all of our stereotypes about hockey players here. This is supposed to be, you know, ironing the couch with your bud and, you know, a steady stream of Coors Lights and cigars and reminiscing about the olden days.
Well, you know, when you're up in California, there's not a lot of hockey players that live where I live, so I just had to stay busy. I would be doing that if I was around the rest of the hockey world and next to them, particularly up there in Toronto with you guys.
Berkey, go ahead. That's good for you, Brett. That's awesome.
Well, Eddie, it's Berkey. Thanks for doing this. Have you forgiven me yet?
Oh, I love you, Berkey. Yes, I've forgiven you.
I traded Eddie back in my first year in Vancouver. He was in the Pavel Bure trade.
The Bure deal,
and I did not want to trade him. I really liked him, but we had to put him in to make the deal.
No, Berkey, I still look back at that moment, and, you know, although it hurt me when I got traded because, every time you get traded as a player, you know, one of two things can happen. One, you can be happy and knowing that there's a team on the other side that wants you. And then there's other times where you're real disappointed, like you felt like somebody gave up on you. And I feel that moment when you guys traded me to Florida with Pavel, I felt like my gut and my heart was stripped out of me. And I feel the reason why I felt that is because, you know, when we went to the finals in 94 against the Rangers with the Canucks, you know, it took some time for that team to kind of rebuild. And I kind of had to go through some of those lean years. But the one thing that happened when you guys traded me is I really took a hard look at myself and realized I had a lot to work on. And that was the moment that I'll never forget. I can still remember that moment of Mike Keenan pulling me into the hallway and saying, "Hey, Brett, we just traded you to the Florida Panthers." And that feeling of, holy cow, these guys gave up on me. They didn't believe in me. And ultimately, at the end of the day, when I saw myself as somebody that needed to get better mentally, I needed to get stronger mentally, I needed to work on my stamina, I needed to work on my strength, and I looked at all of those things with a constructive, critical eye and realized that those are the things I wanted to get better at. And you know what? I committed that day. When I left that place in Dallas, I said, I am never going to let a guy, a coach like Mike Keenan control my brain. I am going to make some things better within my mental capacity, and that's exactly what I went and did. And so, Berkey, you changed my life in a good way, in a lot of ways, and it eventually helped me win a Stanley Cup down in 2006.
Brett, this has all been very inspiring. I'm now going to write my university to see how many credits I need because I think I'm still four short from getting my degree.
You got to do it, man.
I know. I know. Just, you know, looking at your resume, you had such an incredible career, over 1,000 games, and, you were so steady over those years. I do wonder, though, how do you feel like the experience is for an NHL player depending on where you play? Like if you're in Vancouver or Florida or Carolina in these different organizations, do you feel like it's all kind of the same thing? You're an NHL player, you're on planes, you're playing, or is it wildly different from different city to different organization and so on?
I think when I played in Florida, you know, you don't get that feeling of Toronto, right? I mean, let's just call it what it is. You're not in the hockey, heaven, if you will, if you're up there in Toronto, if you're playing there. And when I was in Vancouver, I mean, it was a town that everything kind of revolves around the hockey team. You know, when you're down in Florida, not so much. So I think the environment, you know, does matter. You know, when you really have grown up around hockey, like all of us have, you know, particularly us in Minnesota, Berkey and I, but the organization itself, you know, like when in Carolina, for instance, I mean, yes, it's not Toronto, but what I did feel in Carolina was a group of men that were more interested in the way they worked and how hard they'd come to the rink and you know, put their work boots on every day and train the way it takes to be a champion. And not only train that way, but to treat others with the respect it takes to really get to the next level. And so I don't care if you're in Florida or Carolina or Toronto, those are the ingredients you need to win. And so, yes, the environment, you know, where you live and all of the things around it, surrounding it, yes, sometimes matters. But at the end of the day, it's when you walk in that locker room, what do you have for characters in that room? And are those the characters that you can win with?
You know, with Brett Hedekin, radio analyst for the San Jose Sharks and former Stanley Cup champion, and we're just talking about the Carolina Hurricanes. And before you came on, we were having a conversation about, you know, jump ball seasons and, you know, what is this postseason going to look like now that there's been this, you know, COVID leveling of the playing field. And we were talking about 2006, and that was an interesting year as everybody had to relearn the game, and the premium was now all of a sudden in the sweet spot of your bat, which is foot speed. And the Carolina Hurricanes were the best of the bunch, won the Stanley Cup. But it was one of those years where, you know, teams that thought they had a championship roster constructed were confronted with a zero tolerance policy on obstruction, more of a premium on skating, less of clutching and grabbing. Jonathan Chichu pops 56 goals out of nowhere. Like, describe 2006, well, the whole 205-206 season to us from Brett Hedekin's point of view.
Yeah, it was interesting, right? As you mentioned, just the rule changes and the strict tolerance that, you know, the NHL implemented. When you look back at training camp that year, I can still visualize it. And Peter Laviolette really had all of us defensemen, every drill we did from the onset of the very first day of training camp, of jumping in the play. He literally was yelling at the defensemen every shift, every play, every drill we did to get up in the play, to add to the offense, to be on the throttle, essentially. And from that moment, I think we all got in this mindset of attack. And we weren't going to be obstructed. We were going to be able to skate. We were going to be able to use what we had, which was one of our assets, which is our conditioning. I mean, you didn't have to tell our group to work harder. That was just something that was just inherent. And I think when you've got a bunch of guys that like to work hard, now you've just got to kind of steer those thoroughbreds in the right direction. I think Peter did a good job that year of understanding what he had and then how to get the most out of it. So most of us. But when you look at the way we played, some nights we played seven defensemen because we were trying to jump into play so much that, hey, we almost needed 7D. So it was a year that I thought, obviously, the rule changes really helped us, but we actually took the advantage of it, not only because of the way we played, but because of the conditioning that we had.
Share with us your thoughts of Game 7. That was one of the more entertaining and interesting Game 7s that we've seen in quite some time. And the one thing that stands out to me is I don't think those fans sat down once. Like, the whole time you're waiting for the game to settle in and the fans to get their butts in the seats, but we didn't see it for three periods. It was an insane crowd.
It was. And you know what? They sent an email out, I believe, among the fans somehow, I don't know, a mailing list or whatever they did, but they basically sent a note saying, hey, we're not standing tonight. Our team has been there for us. We're going to be there for them. And that's what they did. They stood the whole game. But you know what I remember from that day is a real calmness in the locker room. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I remember a practice. You know, there's a lot of things you remember. And Berkey, you might remember some of the things of, you know, your Stanley Cup team. And I think there's probably moments that happened during the course of the year that probably just go by the wayside. But I remember a moment in practice in the middle of the year where it was something I'd never seen before. It was a pace up and down the ice that I'd never seen. The passing, the execution, the level of just commitment to be the best that they could be in practice. And I remember Laviolette kind of pulling us all in after practice and saying, he just kind of paused and looked at us all. And as he looked at us, he said, you know, if we keep practicing like this, nobody will touch us this year. We're going to win the Stanley Cup. And so I take that story and I just fast forward to Game 7. Before that game, I felt the calmness in the locker room that was, you know, like the work had been done. Like, let's go out there because we know we put the time in, we put the effort. Let's stand in the middle of the ring and let's go down swinging. And I felt that confidence in our room, and you know, we went out and executed in Game 7.
Berkey?
Yeah, that was your playoff. I was looking through this last night, Hedy, and man, oh man, you guys had so many one goal games and overtime games, getting there past Montreal, New Jersey, Buffalo, Edmonton. Boy, it was cardiac hits.
You know what, Berkey? It's amazing you said one-goal games. I went back and looked at the 2006 Carolina Hurricane team all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals. I believe that we have more one-goal games than any other team in history. And you can double-check this, and we can kind of talk about this next time we're on a call. But what does that tell you about conditioning? What does it tell you about detail that you're winning one-goal games and that you're comfortable in one-goal games? It's an incredible stat to think about when constructing a team and when constructing the thought of how important details are. And I thought that's a great point that you just made, Berkey, and I love that you pointed that out.
We did the same thing the next year. Our team was – I think we had the record, or you tied you or right behind you for one-goal games, but we played fewer games. We only played 21 games, so –
That's yeah, right. I was just gonna jump in. I mean, that's a symmetry from 206 to 207 from Brett from your Carolina Hurricanes to Berkey's Anaheim Ducks. I'm not sure how many Carolina had, but Brian, I checked this a couple of weeks ago, and I think it was 12 one-goal games that you guys had. So everything that Brett is saying here about, you know, being comfortable in tight games and not collapsing, I mean, that all applied to your team one season later.
Yeah, and trust in your goaltender too. If you're gonna play on a narrow margin like that, you got to really trust your target.
Yeah, that's a good point. Trusting your old goaltender, but again, you know, you're looking at a team that's real comfortable in those one goal games, and that talks about confidence and also talks about depth. You've got to have depth of four lines and six or even sometimes seven defensemen that can get out there and you have confidence with.
So on the other end of this, Brett, after all those one-goal victories and the success, something happened to you that I've always been fascinated by, and I'd love to know what happens. North St. Paul declared Brett Hedekin Day. What does it entail when someone – do you still celebrate Brett Hedekin Day on August 12th every year? What happens when they name a day after you?
Oh, man, that's hilarious. No, I do not celebrate. It was the day I had the Stanley
you
Cup.
Should.
Yeah. Maybe I have a cocktail and cheers to the guys I won with. But, our town of North St. Paul, they have this big snowman in the middle of it. And Mayor Sandberg had been the mayor there for I don't know how many decades. But he declared that day was, my day. But he also put the Carolina Hurricane logo and my number on this big snowman that stands about 55 feet tall. And nothing has ever been painted on there since, and nothing had been painted on there before that. And so I was real proud to be able to bring the Stanley Cup back there that day on my day of the Stanley Cup. They did a parade for me, and that was the day they retired my number and so forth. But just what a journey it's been to be a hockey player in the NHL and what it's given me, and just all the people I've met, like Berkey, along the way that have been just great people.
Brett, do you have a quarantine beard going?
No, it's a clean shaven right now. I'm a studying college kid again, so you can call me Berkey. You know what they call kids like us? College pukes. That's what I am right now.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is, when's the last time you could say that your beard was the same length as Joe Thornton's?
Oh, man. Well, he just shaved his, too, but beard of 06, that beard of 06 was... it was good. It was thick, and it's right up there in the top, right? It's been rated, so I think I'm proud of that. It's my one thing I'm proud of that run was I had a good beard.
What did you make of Joe Thornton saying, "That's it, I'm done, I'm out"?
With the beard or just
when
he's retiring? What do you mean?
Yeah, with the beard. The beard.
It's good. I think it's good. I think it'll make him look younger. I mean, he's a fit guy, for the most part. I mean, he looks like he may have stepped it back a little bit here during this quarantine. But for a guy that's played, and Berkey, you've been around this game longer than I have. This guy and the way he plays, the way he thinks the game, have you seen anybody like it?
I mean, he's a freak. He's a unicorn, yeah.
No, I agree.
And for a guy to be that good a player and last that long and be that well-liked, like everyone loves this guy.
Yes, in that locker room, you're right. I mean, I think when you watch him on a daily basis, and I've had the chance to do that covering the Sharks, he's just been every day you watch him, he's one of those first guys on the ice. He's hooting and hollering every day. He loves the game. And I think with that type of attitude, it becomes infectious to other guys around him. So, yeah, there's the reason in itself why he's played so long.
And not just that, I met around the league. Like, he's beloved around the league. Like, he never gets booed in Anaheim. He never gets booed any place. Like a guy that's been there 20 years, those guys get booed everywhere. And this guy is respected league-wide. It's hilarious to watch.
It is. Yeah, he's just a beloved man. Yeah, he's a great guy. I've had the chance to get to know him here the last, 6-7 years. And I'll tell you, he's become a real good close friend of mine.
Alongside Brett Hedekin, analyst for the San Jose Sharks and former NHL defenseman, Stanley Cup champion with the 2006 Carolina Hurricanes. I know the San Jose Sharks aren't part of it, but what do you make, Brett, of the proposed return-to-play format with the 24-team playoff and the quick sprint to get to 16?
Well, maybe you guys can give me a little update on that. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have probably already heard it, but I've been so locked in on the school thing and studying every day. I mean, give me a heads up. I mean, if that's the case, 24 teams and a sprint, I would love to see the Stanley Cup awarded this year. I really would.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to see a blank spot like it did in 2005 before we won it, that where a Stanley Cup team should be, where the names of guys that have committed to each other that are engraved in that Stanley Cup, and when you raise it, that's what it means. to see right. blank spots on that cup, I don't want to see it. And I'd love to see those guys and players and teams raise that cup this year. So that's my hope, is that we can somehow get it done, sprint or not, make it happen.
Our fingers are crossed for all of it. I want to finish up here by asking you about the San Jose Sharks. The one thing we've seen about, a couple of things with Doug Wilson. One of the things that I've always marveled at is how not only can he acquire players, but when he acquires players, they stay. I mean, that's going to be, I think, one of the legacies of Doug Wilson with San Jose, is guys stay there when Doug Wilson brings them. How quickly can San Jose turn this thing around, do you think, Brett?
Well, I think they've got it's a great point about Doug, first of all. I think he has a way about him, the way he talks to you, the way he makes you feel important. He'll bring players in his room a lot. He's taken me in his office many a times to kick the tires, and I feel he's just got that type of personality where you want to be around him and you want to play for him. I think they have the building blocks to turn it around fairly rapidly, just because, you know, you've got a guy like Erik Karlsson. Yes, it's been a little bit topsy-turvy since him coming here to San Jose. Evander Kane is a player for me that I scratch my head at sometimes, just because you see the way he can perform some nights is elite. And the way he plays on the edge, can you corral him and get the most out of him for 82 games? And then more importantly, not even so much 82 games, is can you get that guy that's on the edge in the playoffs for 25 games? And I think that's the question a guy like Kane has to ask himself, is how can I be a dominant player throughout the whole four rounds of the playoffs? And I think he finally had that taste of playoffs, in the last couple runs here with San Jose. And is he looking at himself as knowing that he's got some weaknesses? I think so. Ultimately, the answer to your question would be, they've got the pieces. Now do the players want to dig down deep and find ways of going all the way to the end and winning a cup, and then filling it backfilling with guys that they've lost throughout, either trade or, if they do lose a guy like Joe Thornton. So there's a lot of things that still need to happen, I think, for them to get back on track, but they've got the pillars, if you will.
Our fingers are crossed. Brett, thanks so much for stopping by. Continued success at school. What did you call them? Pukes? What is it?
College Pukes.
Best of luck on campus again, Brett. And good to hear that your family is healthy and well. We'll look forward to catching up down the road.
Thanks, Justin, Brian, and Jeff. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
There he is. Brett Hedekin, former Stanley Cup champion, now San Jose Sharks radio analyst, and someone that Brian Burke traded. Anyone ever hold a grudge, Brian, for you trading them?
Hedy was mad at me for a while. Oh, yeah, he was mad at me for a while. And Peter Schaefer was mad at me for a while, a long time after I traded him. But I kind of mended that fence a couple of years ago in Vancouver. I bumped into him in a hotel lobby, and we talked it out. Good guy. But, Hedy was sour. He didn't talk to me for a couple of years.
Really, eh? I understand it.
He just played in the finals, right? So he was on the Canucks that went to the finals.
Yeah,
I come in.
That's fair.
I have to put him in the Bure deal. I traded Brian McCabe to get the Sedins. I hated that trade. I hated trading Brian McCabe. I loved him. But he got it right away. When I talked to him, I said, look, you're my kind of player. I love you, but I'm getting the Twins. I got to do this. I'd do it again.
He was on the program a couple of days ago, and he mentioned that you gave him the heads up the day before it happened. Like, look, if I can pull this off, that means that you're going. And you know what?
Yeah.
To be honest with you, Brian, I think that's a really classy move by you to call the guy before to say, hey, heads up, no surprises here. Prepare for what might be a tough landing tomorrow. And if it doesn't happen, then it doesn't happen.
Look, I'll tell you right now, there's some guys you trade, and you almost break your finger calling them on their phone, because you're so happy to get him on an airplane. And you tell the trainer, bring his stuff up to my office, and I'll drive this bastard to the airport. That's how you feel about trading some guy. And some guys, you start to dial a number, and you have to stop. And then you start, and you have to stop again, because you hate it.
Yeah.
I traded Matt Stajan to get Dion Phaneuf. I hated trading Matt Stajan. He's a great kid.
I understand. I get it. Thanks to Brett Hedekin for stopping by. We... When it comes to trades, I mean, one of the biggest and most lopsided trades the Maple Leafs ever made was acquiring Bill Dorlego from Vancouver alongside our next guest, former 50-goal scorer with the Toronto Maple Leafs, Rick Vi, former NHL forward, joins us in moments. Hockey Central continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to the program. I want to thank Brett Hedekin for stopping by Hockey Central alongside Brian Burke and Justin Bourne. I'm Jeff Merrick, and pleased to be joined now by one of the best Leafs to ever wear the jersey. Big 22 coming down the right side with the big slap shot, 50-goal seasons. Rick Vi joining us now on Hockey Central. RV, how are you today?
I'm great, Jeff. How are you?
Good. Great to hear your voice. And I do know the answer to this, but for all of our listeners, because it is one of my favorite nickname stories. Normally, anyone who comes from PEI, their nickname is Spud. How did you get the nickname Squid, though?
Oh, boy. That was 1978 when I was playing in Birmingham. And, of course, John Brophy, Colorful John, was our coach. Yep. And we were doing power play at one end and everybody at the other. And then it was our turn to do the power play. So Craig Hartsburg standing beside him, and he's screaming, Squid. And he asked him, he said, who are you calling? And he said, Vibe. He said, oh, you mean Spud. And, of course, Brophy with his language and everything. I don't give a whatever you call him. Just get him down here. And then it just stuck. It was one of those things that it's kind of weird when you think about it. But it went from Spud to Squid in one practice, and then that was it. And it's been Squid right up till today.
I just love it. Brian Burke, you're on with Rick Vibe.
Hey, Rick. How you doing, buddy?
Good, Berkey. How are you?
I'm doing well. So the 1979 entry draft, you go fifth overall to Vancouver. There are a lot of people in hockey, including me, that think that was the best first round ever. Tell us about that day.
Well, it was actually a weird day because of the WHA being absorbed into the NHL to go to 21 teams that year. So the draft was in August, and it was a phone draft. So there was nowhere where we're going to get drafted or anything. We were just kind of waiting by the phone and waiting for things to happen. The funniest thing about that draft is I was interviewed by Washington, and there was a big article in the newspaper by one of the writers there as well. And I was pretty sure I was going to go to Washington fourth, but they took Mike Gartner. So not a bad choice either.
Pretty good.
But off I went to Vancouver and fifth overall, and things didn't quite work out that well at the beginning there. So off to Toronto that February.
Justin?
Rick, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what it's like being one of the faces of the Toronto Maple Leafs. You know, you've been around the franchise. You had such great success here, and fans know you so well. What is the experience like just being around the city and being an ambassador for the club everywhere you go?
Oh, boy. It's well, first of all, it's fantastic. It's, you know, I don't know if you get that very many places. Maybe in other sports, there's other cities. But in hockey, I got to think, you know, Montreal, Toronto, maybe New York City to a degree. But, I mean, you just, it's unbelievable. You're with that organization, one of the original six teams, and you know, well, Toronto and Montreal, the most Stanley Cups in the NHL. It's just fantastic. And even later on, I'm 61, you just turned 61, and I'm still going places and people are coming up and asking for autographs and everything. So, you know, I've always said, everybody said, how do you do that? Like, sign autographs all the time. I said, hey, when they stop asking you, that's when you worry.
with Rick Vi, former 50-goal scorer of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Rick, I want to ask you about Justin, your son. Someone told me, geez, a couple of months ago that he is either, because I know he's still playing, but is he a player coach or he's looking to get into coaching now? Justin, of course, you know, locally here in Toronto, played on that powerhouse Marlboros team back in the NHL lockout year, that minor midget squad that I think only lost one game. Who would have been on that squad? Let's see, Sam Gagne, John Tavares, Brendan Smith, like a powerhouse team. Tell us about Justin right now.
Well, he's doing great. He's actually here with us. His season was canceled. He was playing in Cincinnati in the ECHL as a player assistant coach. And
okay.
He'd love to get into coaching, and he's in on all the meetings and going over tape and stuff like that. So I think he'd be a great coach. He's kind of gone through a couple of different eras of the game and how it's changed. So he kind of knows exactly what's going on in both eras, and he can put a team together that has a little bit of grit and determination as well as some skill. So I think he'd be pretty good at it, but he's still playing, and all 6'6", 240 pounds of him is lugging around, scoring goals and doing still doing pretty good.
You know we this is interesting that you're on today, because to kick off the program, we had Martin St-Louis on the show, and always good catching up with Marty. And you had him, you know, in that era where he really first started to put it all together, albeit at the American Hockey League level. You were his coach in the St. John Flames. What did you see in Martin St-Louis back then?
Well, I saw a guy, first of all, who worked harder than everybody else. Whether it was practice, whether it was games, didn't matter. Marty was the hardest working guy on the ice. He probably had the biggest legs in hockey at the time.
Yeah.
And so he was powerful. And I think everybody looked at him and said, he's too small. And every time Calgary would call and say, we need a forward or we need a winger, Marty would be the first name I'd bring up. And the next day I'd come in and they're packing someone else's bag. And finally, I think in the second year I was there, he got called up at the end of the year for a few months. But he played on the fourth line and hardly played at all. And then we had our meetings and to discuss the depth of the organization. And they had him right at the bottom. And I had an argument with Todd Button, who was a scout. Mm-hmm. And I said, this guy's got to play. I mean, they had a chance to sign him for $500,000 1 year. And I said, if you play him with good players and play him regular, he's a 30-30 guy at least, minimum. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't think he'd go on and win scoring championships and everything else, but I knew he could play. And so anyway, off he goes to Tampa for nothing. And, the rest is history. Now he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And a great Ricky? Kid. Great, great kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Rick, tell us about the Baby Bulls.
Oh, boy. Well, the Baby Bulls, it started out, the six of us, it was Keith Crowder, myself, Rob Ramage, Craig Hartsburg, Gaston Gingras, and Pat Riggin. And but then Michel Goulet came on his own, and he was only 18. We were all 19. And then Keith Crowder went back to Peterborough in November because he wasn't getting much ice time, and they won the Memorial Cup that year. But it was fantastic. It was kind of a great learning year for us, stepping in at 19 and playing against men, and which was a little difficult at times because the older guys, they'd be out all the time after games or even for lunch every day. And those lunches started at noon or 1 o'clock and went till 10, not two or three. And, they're playing backgammon in the dressing room like an hour and a half before the game and stuff like that. And so kind of looking at that, it just, you kind of got a lay of the way things were. And even in the NHL, it wasn't quite like that, but still the older guys did different things. And so you had to be careful, otherwise you got caught up in a lot of it, which sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't, but more times than not I did, unfortunately.
that was such an interesting, Justin, sorry, I'm going to jump over, I just want to follow up with a WHA question. The year that you were there in Birmingham, and there was all, and I think you played on a line with Michel Goulet, if I'm not mistaken. That was a year after the Birmingham Bulls just tore the league apart with players like Frankie Beaton and Steve D'Urbano and Bad News Bilodeau. And then those guys left, and all of a sudden it was up to a lot of younger guys to help to try to defend their teammates with the Belleville Bulls. Did you guys feel like you were paying the receipts for the year previous?
Oh, absolutely. Every other team just loaded up on tough guys, and it was payback time. And unfortunately, all us young guys were kind of stuck in the middle of it. And I mean, I had 248. penalty minutes, I think, that year. I probably had about 8 broken noses, and I got beat up all the whole year. But you know what? The big thing was he showed up,
and you showed them that you weren't going to go anywhere. And I think, and even in early days in the NHL, I did the same thing. You know, hey, I'm not going anywhere. I don't care what you do to me. And I think that eventually gave me more room and gave me a little bit more respect.
That's really interesting you went there. That's exactly where my question is, because there's like a four-year span in your NHL career where I can't imagine you had a single game where you weren't on the score sheet. You had about 200 goals and 500 PIMs over these years, but the PIMs kind of back off a little bit as the goals go up, and I'm wondering if that was a conscious thing. Like you said, okay, I don't need to do that part so much. I can focus more on the offensive side.
Well, actually, it wasn't me that came up with that, to be quite honest with you. It was Mike Nikolic was our coach at the time, and Mike, you know, he would always call us in for one-on-one meetings, not necessarily talking about hockey, but other things. And he called me in one day, and he said, Rick, he says, we got a little bit of a problem here. He says, we need you on the ice. We can't have you in the penalty box so much because we need you on the ice to score goals. And it was the best thing I ever heard from a coach in my entire life. It was like, oh, boy, great. I don't have to fight anymore, not as much. So he was the one that brought it up. I consciously tried to do that and tried to stay on the ice a little bit more. And because of that, the goal totals started going up.
350 goal seasons. And, you know, when I think of those years, Rick, with Rick Vai, former Maple Leaf 50 goal scorer, I think of this amazing combination. You guys were traded together. And we're fantastic together with the Maple Leafs. That builder Lego to Rick Five pass was always a thing of beauty, and you were there to bury it. Describe your relationship with builder Lego back at that point in your career.
Well, we became good friends pretty early in Vancouver because he was a fourth overall pick the year before and had been struggling a little bit. With Harry Neal was a coach, and he wasn't one of Harry's favorites. Neither was I when I came in. So we kind of hung out together because sometimes we didn't dress. And then we got traded together. And the only thing Punch said to us when he made the trade was, hey, guys, you're going to get a great opportunity to play a lot here. Go out and do your thing. And Billy was fantastic. I mean, Billy and I, when we started playing together a lot in Toronto, it just kind of instantly we had chemistry. And he knew what I was going to do. I knew what he was going to do. We even had a perfect play at Maple Leaf Gardens that if I was, you know, going to be offside because we had the red line at the time, he would fire it off the end boards and I'd just go down the wall and it would come right out on the dot and I could just step into it and just rip it from there. And but Billy was a great guy. He was the best man at my wedding almost 39 years ago now.
Wow. You know, it was, and I can still, I remember the play and the pass and the finish, and Mike Liu was in net, and it's the first 50, in Toronto Maple Leafs history. Describe that to us from your point of view, Rick.
Well, I'm kind of in the corner and banging around, and the puck comes up the wall, it gets to Billy at the blue line. He starts going to the middle of the ice, and so I just come out of the corner, and I kind of get up in the top of the circle and I see Billy going to the other side. I know exactly what he's doing and where he wants to go and what he wants to do. He beats two guys. And then, so I obviously circle back and know that there's a beautiful backhand pass coming across. And it was just a matter of one timing it past Liute. And even Guy Lapointe was in that picture. He was trying to block it. Mm. But, I always said to Mike Liu, too, is funny because every time I saw him, I'd say, Mike, I got a bunch of those pictures left. Would you like me to sign one for you? So that didn't go over very well. But anyway, it was Billy was a great centerman and great setup guy. And I mean, you got to don't forget, too, he had 92 goals in the Western Hockey League in 50 some games one year before he got hurt. So he could score goals, too.
Oh, no, he was, I mean, that was with the Brandon Wheat Kings. He was supremely skilled. He was amongst, when it came to skills, Billy DeLego was amongst the elite in his era. Berkey, go ahead.
Rick, you get asked about, you know, walking around town being a Leaf, but talk about the Leafs alumni. They do a tremendous job in the community.
Well, they do a great job. And we have a real good board of directors, and then we have some people from MLSE on the board as well and so on. And you know, we all go out and we do a lot of things in the community, but the things that we do, we just donated $1 million to 5 different charities in the community. And the guys are going to Launchpad, and we work pretty closely with the MLSE Foundation too, which is Launchpad and a lot of other hockey in the neighborhood, where we go out and give kids equipment and get on the ice with them and have a little bit of fun. So our alumni is fantastic, and a lot of guys are involved. It's you know, I mean, we have one of the biggest alumni in the National Hockey League, probably the second biggest, if not the biggest, and everybody gets involved, and it's a lot of fun.
What do you what impresses you right now, Rick, about the game as it's played today?
Probably just the skill level of the players. You know, you look around the league and you look at every team, their top 6 forwards. I mean, the skill level is just off the charts. But again, it's a different era, and we didn't have skill coaches and didn't do that kind of stuff back in our day. But they do now, and they have to stay up with everybody else. But the skill level of the top players in the league right now is just, it's off the charts, really. I mean, the only guys I ever saw with skill like that could do all those things were guys like McGillney and Burre and guys like that. Now you got a whole bunch of guys that can do that in the league now.
Justin, go ahead.
Rick, I'm about 10 years since I played my last game of meaningful hockey, and I have days where I wonder, like, hey, can I still play at a decent level? And I can't help noticing your Hockey DB page has 9 games with the Dundas Real McCoys, 10
yeah.
years after your last pro game. Tell us about what led you to giving that a crack and how it went for you.
Oh, boy, that's... Well, I was playing a lot of alumni games and with the NHL alumni and the Leaf alumni, a few here and there. A guy named Don Robertson, who I actually ended up becoming really good friends with, ran the Real McCoys, and he asked me if I'd like to play. I was 41, I believe, at the time. And I said, what the hell? I'll give it a shot. And, you know, so I went in, and, of course, practices, you know, you have one or two per week, but most of the guys didn't show up because they were working and they couldn't get to practice. And I had a lot of fun. The guys were fantastic in the room. A lot of them had played, you know, minor pro, played pro in Europe, and came back and played senior hockey. Senior hockey was pretty good back then, and I had a lot of fun. It was just a way to get back into the game. And then during the lockout in 85, I actually coached the team that whole year. So it was great. It's was, you know, you're staying in the game, you're involved, and that's the best part about it.
Rick, before we let you go, I want to ask you about, like, when you look back at your career, like, I know the 50 goals are one thing, but sometimes it's what we think is a meaningless game on a Tuesday night, or like an exchange at an airport with someone. When you look back on your career, you know, what are some of the moments outside of the big, huge ones that come to your mind right away?
Wow, that's you know what? I get that question a lot, and I'll be honest with you, but when I look at highlights, yeah, there's a few big ones in there, but I look at it as I got to play in the best hockey league in the world for 13 years. And to me, coming from Charlottetown PEI, that is a highlight in its own. Mm. And to be able to average a goal every 2 games, over 800 and whatever the heck it was, 76 or something. The whole thing, the complete, and then, you know, interacting with the fans. You got to remember, too, back then at the Gardens, we'd walk out on the church or Wood Street, and there'd be 100 people waiting there in the middle of the winter. And we'd stand there and sign as many as we could. And then, of course, your wife's standing there, and she's looking at you. So I go, okay, we're going up the street to have dinner. You can follow me if you'd like an autograph, but I really do have to get going. And this is after 45 minutes or so. So interacting with the fans and just the fact that I got to play in the best league in the world for 13 years, I don't think it gets much better than that, unless you play 20 years.
And my final question then, what happened to that fur coat that we used to always see Rick Five strutting around Toronto in?
It was in the closet for so long, and then I remember one day I thought I'd bring it out and
put it on, and my gosh, it didn't even come close to fitting me. I mean, when I got it, I was probably about 185 pounds, and now 210. It just wasn't even close. So I don't know where it is. My wife probably gave it to some charitable thing or something, and but it's no longer around.
Alas.
Yeah, it's gone.
we all have the memories. We have great memories of you, Rick, and those 50 goals in Toronto. Listen, thanks so much for stopping by. To you and the family, be well, be safe, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. We're doing great. And you guys have a great day. And, again, stay safe as well. It's a tough time, but, hey, the golf courses are open, which is great because now I've been out 7 days in a row, so that's kind of nice.
Ooh. And listen, and the weather's great as well. Not a cloud in the sky. And if you're a golfer, enjoy it. Squid, thanks so much for stopping by.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks a lot.
There he is, Rick Vai, former 50-goal shooter for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Quick pause, back to wrap up another edition of Hockey Central. Brian Burke, Justin Bourne, Jeff Merrick, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We're back in a flash.
Now, more Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Okay, really quickly, guys, to wrap up, and Brian, a particular note to you, the Hall of Fame, Hockey Hall of Fame, just tweeting this out. Selection committee manuals have been sent out to committee members as we prepare for the first selection made digitally. The class of 2020 will be announced on June the 24th. This is new territory, Berkey, for the Hall of Fame selection committee.
Yes, and my package arrived. I was nervous someone had pounded on the door while we were doing the show, but it got here around 10 o'clock this morning.
Okay, so the Aginlas, the Hosas, the Alfredsons, the Gonchars, the Eliashes, the Brindamores, Curtis Joseph, Alex McGillney, and some of the older ones, Doug Wilson, Kevin Lowe, Boris Mikhailov could be a candidate as well. We shall stay tuned. Guys, you stay safe. Have a wonderful weekend. Is anyone golfing this weekend, you two? Are you golfing?
I don't golf.
I'm not going to be golfing for a long time. I have a newborn.
That's a good point. And I'm with you, Berkey. I'm surrounded by golf courses up here in Stouffville, and it's lost on me. But if you're golfing, enjoy it. Thanks for joining us on Hockey Central. We're back Monday at noon.